Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 323 of the Divine Intervention Podcasts. And in this podcast, I'll be talking about immunocompromised individuals, transplant patients, and the MBME exams. So this is a podcast where it's gonna be organized, but it's gonna kind of be like a treatment of just people that are immunocompromised and different variations of things. It's almost kind of like a nebulous topic, but I'll try to pare it down and keep fluff to a minimum. But basically, I want to emphasize many of the high yield points that the MBMEs care about in people that are immunocompromised, in people that are post-transplant or, you know, getting a transplant of some sort, and just emphasize certain scenarios. This is one of those things that are best learned by way of scenarios. So hopefully by the end of this lesson, you should feel a lot better about that this material. And for those of you that listen to this podcast, I mean, many of you know I'm a Christian. Many people have sent me lots and lots of emails that, oh, Divine, we really like your life lessons. So if you're looking for like Bible-based teaching, very short podcast of like 10 minutes or less on just life lessons. I actually started a new website recently. It's called Divine Intervention Life Lessons. So every now and then, I will still talk about some life lessons with these podcasts, like the regular Divine Intervention podcasts. But I will be making weekly, just regular life lesson podcasts on the Divine Intervention Life Lessons podcast. It's actually on Apple Podcast as well. And I'll encourage you, just go to divineinterventionlifelessons.com and you'll get more information on that. And then for those that are studying for Step 2 CK or Step 3, I have a test-taking strategies course that starts tomorrow between 2 and 4:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. So that's like 5 to 7:30 Eastern Time. And then I have the 20-hour comprehensive course starting on Tuesday from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. So that's pretty much from 2 p.m. to 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. So if you're interested, just shoot me an email through the website and I'll give you some more information. Okay, so let's start off talking about immunocompromised folks first. And again, I'll look at it from many different angles. The thing is, on the USMLE exams, they are not very, oh, we're going to talk about this specific thing. No, the MBMEs are about being able to make integrations. So I will try really hard to make integrations with this topic. Some people like when integrations are made. Some people don't like it. It's kind of unsettling to people in some respects. But the problem is, if you're not able to make integrations, then any question that is tested on the USMLEs that goes beyond just basic knowledge, you'll very likely struggle with those kinds of questions. So it's very important to be able to see things from many different modalities. That's why you may see that a lecture that I may call an immunology lecture, maybe a lecture that I then talk about a lot of hematology, a lot of pulmonology, a lot of cardiology. That's ultimately the best way to learn and be able to apply information. Because again, even in the real world, when you see patients as a resident, as a physician, they're not going to present as cookie cutter cases, right? There are some people that practice cookie cutter medicine. And again, for the most part, that's helpful. That's not a problem. You know, patient can come in with garden variety pneumonia and you treat them and no problem, right? But then there may be some patients that come in with pneumonia, but that pneumonia is a manifestation of something else, right? That's why you see if a person is not properly trained or not able to think in multiple dimensions, you then see them they miss huge things in patient care. So again, I'll encourage you, have that mindset that I'll be a multimodal thinker as I take care of patients. But let me get off that soapbox. Let's jump right into it. So the first thing about immunocompromises in general, as a person gets older, right, they get more immunocompromised, right? So a person's immune system gets just weaker in general as they get older. I mean, obviously, there are things you can do to mitigate that by being healthy, by not having chronic disease. Because again, if you notice, during this COVID pandemic, the people that got in trouble quite significantly were people that were really old and had lots of medical comorbidities. Also, being malnourished makes you immunocompromised. Many people don't think about it, but infection is a common complication of having an eating disorder, like anorexia nervosa, for example. Because again, if you are malnourished, remember your immune system is literally built on proteins as a macromolecule. So if you're malnourished in that circumstance, or a child has kwashiorkor, so they can give you an NBME question about a child with kwashiorkor getting recurrent infections. Well, those kids will get a lot of recurrent bacterial infections because they are not consuming protein. Literally, you cannot make antibodies if you don't have adequate amounts of protein in your body. So those kids tend to get recurrent infections with encapsulated organisms, right? Obviously, if a person has HIV, right, that's more of a matter of cell-mediated immunity, right? So they have a T-cell problem. And because they have a T-cell problem, they get a lot of viral infections, a lot of fungal infections, a lot of infections with pneumocystis jervetii. In fact, I'll talk about bug patterns in a bit. Right? Or if a person has a malignancy, right, like having CLL, for example. The thing is, if you see like a CVID-like presentation in a person over the age of 60, on NBME exams, they likely have CLL. Usually those people, they will have a crazy high white count, but because it's a lymphocytic leukemia, right, it will not be myeloid cells that will predominate, it'll be lymphoid cells. You notice their white count is 100,000, 80% of it is lymphocytes, and you see them getting recurrent infections. Well, the thing is, those lymphocytes that are proliferating, they're not really making antibodies, or if they make antibodies, those antibodies are trash, so they don't work. So those people have a risk of recurrent infections. Or if a person has no spleen, remember there are many reasons why people can have no spleen. A common cause on NBME exams is sickle cell disease, right? If a person has sickle cell disease, they have functionally splenia by the age of 5 because they have auto-infarcted their spleens. Or let's say a person has gotten a splenectomy for some kind of disorder. Let's say they've gotten it for hereditary spherocytosis. Remember, splenectomy is the treatment of choice in hereditary spherocytosis, or splenectomy is a third-line treatment for immune thrombocytopenia in patients that have lupus, for example, right? So when people have no spleen, then they are predisposed to getting infections. And typically, again, those infections tend to be from encapsulated organisms. The most common cause of infection, there's actually very high yield to know. The most common cause of infection and sepsis in people that have no spleen is strep pneumo. Pneumococcal sepsis is the most common cause of sepsis in people that have no spleen, right? Or if people have some kind of immunodeficiency disease, so let's say they have like Bruton's A gamma globulinemia, where their B cells don't mature, or they have like hyper IgM syndrome, where they have a class switching defect, where they can go from IgM to IgG or IgA, then those things are going to put those people at high risk of having infection, especially again, infection with bacterial organisms. Also, if a person is diabetic, diabetes is an immunocompromised state. Many times, as you've seen me illustrate in many podcasts, people that have diabetes, they tend to get the short end of the stick with infections. So you may see normal people getting pyelonephritis, but then you see people that have diabetes getting complications like emphysematous pyelonephritis, where you have like gas bubbles in the wall of your kidneys, or you see them having a perinephric abscess, where they have a fluid collection in the walls of the kidneys, or you see them getting like cholecystitis, but then they get a bad complication like gangrenous cholecystitis on NBME exams, where again, you're seeing like gas bubbles in the walls of the person's gallbladder. These things tend to have very high morbidity and mortality, right? Or you see people that have Fournier's gangrene. Many times people that have Fournier's gangrene, that's basically necrotizing fasciitis of the perineum. Again, that's classically found in people that have diabetes on NBME exams. Or think of people that have mucormycosis. So they'll give you a sinus infection in a person that is in DKA, or a person that is in HHNS, or a person that has polycontrol diabetes. Again, those things all arise in people that have diabetes on NBME exams. Or you see a person that has recurring candidal vaginal infections. Again, that's pretty classic in people that have diabetes. Diabetes is an immunocompromised state. And also, this is one of the reasons why people that are pregnant tend to have a lot of infections. Remember, pregnancy is an immunocompromised state because remember, our immune system is not very tolerant of things that are foreign. The thing is, when a baby comes from a woman, right, that baby that is growing in the woman is almost like a foreign organism. So the body does not necessarily, like basically your immune system develops, again, I'm not going to go deep into immunology here, but the immune system actually develops a kind of tolerance to the baby, so the baby is not destroyed. This is why many times when a person gets pregnant, many inflammatory and rheumatologic disorders tend to calm down. Like for example, it's been well studied in the literature. Many people that have rheumatoid arthritis, they tend to have very few flares of rheumatoid arthritis when they get pregnant. But after the baby is delivered, the rheumatoid arthritis comes back in a big way. This is almost like a rule with many rheumatologic diseases because there is pervasive immune tolerance during pregnancy. That's why many times people that have rheumatologic disease, that disease again calms down during pregnancy. And then if a person is on chronic corticosteroid therapy, again, I'm just basically giving you many different vignettes that you can use to craft or frame an immunocompromised question on your exam. If you know these different scenarios, then nothing will sound out of the blue to you on the exam. Again, especially on these newer USMLE exams, because you see people, they take these exams and they say, wow, I felt like I was guessing for like most of the questions. Again, it's the same general classic concepts they are testing. They're just finding unusual ways to test these things. So again, that's why you need to be able to think in multiple dimensions. So if a person is on chronic corticosteroid therapy, let's say they have really bad asthma, again, that can predispose those people to recurrent infections. Or if a person just got chemotherapy for some kind of malignancy, right? Again, that can predispose these people to getting infections. Or if a person has been on a TNF inhibitor, right? Like adalimumab, etanercept, which is a decoy TNF receptor, those things can all predispose to a person having infections, right? If a person is a post-transplant recipient, people that have gotten transplants, right? They tend to have, again, they're taking big-time immunosuppression. Those things can cause lots of problems in people. And one thing I want to go ahead and say, maybe the next maybe major heading I want to go into is just talking about different patterns of infection, different patterns of infection. Patterns of infection are very helpful for NBME exams because the thing is, for those of you that have listened to my immunodeficiency diseases podcast, that's episode 173, which is a high yield podcast, by the way, to listen to for any of the USMLE exams. One thing that helps with many of these immunodeficiency disease questions is almost like the NBME is one of their best kept secrets, is just understanding patterns of infection. If you understand patterns of infection, then many times you may not even necessarily need to know the exact immunodeficiency disease that these people are suffering from. You may not need to know the exact diagnosis that, oh, they have SCID or they have this. No. Many times you can know what is going on just by the kinds of infections they're getting, right? So the thing is, there are four classic patterns of infection I want to deal with here that the NBME loves to go after. The first one is if a person has a problem with cell-mediated immunity. If a person has a problem with cell-mediated immunity, remember, cell-mediated immunity basically refers to your T cells. So usually these people will tend to, the pattern of infection you'll see pervasively throughout the question is they'll have problems with viruses, right? They'll have problems with fungi. They'll have problems with parasites. They'll have problems with TB. They'll have problems with pneumocystis jervetzi. Those are the classic things you'll find in people that have issues with cell-mediated immunity, right? So again, what are some classic diagnoses that go along with cell-mediated immunity problems, right? Well, HIV, right? It's an immunodeficiency disease of cell-mediated immunity, right? Your T cells basically get destroyed, right? If a person is taking big-time chemotherapy, many times that ends up causing a lot of problems with cell-mediated immunity. Or if you see a newborn or a person that is a few weeks old with all these diverse infections, think about SCID, right? Severe combined immunodeficiency. That's a cell-mediated immunity problem. Another one is if you see a child with seizures or with fish, like craniofacial abnormalities or like a VSD or tetralogy of Fallot, or you notice that they have cleft lip, cleft palate. If you see those things, I hope you're thinking about DeGeorge syndrome. Remember, in DeGeorge syndrome, your third and fourth pharyngeal pouches don't form. If they don't form, you're not going to form a thymus. So your T cells are not going to mature. That's going to cause a cell-mediated immune defect, right? So again, viruses, fungi, parasites, TB, pneumocystis jervetzi, that's a classic construct on NBME exams that goes with a cell-mediated immunity problem. Now, the next big pattern is humoral immunity, right? So this is B cells. They use many different names for this. B cell mediated immunity. So B cells, right? B cells, or they may call it antibody mediated immunity, or they may call this humoral immunity. The big thing I want you to think about here are bacterial infections, especially encapsulated organisms. So things like those Shin organisms we learn about, right? Strep pneumo, Haemophilus influenza, Neisseria meningitidis, Salmonella typhi, Group B strep, remember Strep A galactiae, right? Those are all encapsulated organisms. That's a classic construct for people that have humoral immunity problems, right? So what are some classic diagnoses that go with humoral immunity problems on NBME exams? Well, think about CLL, right? Again, remember CLL is a senior citizen's disease. It's going to be in people over the age of 60 on NBM exams. Or if people have multiple myeloma, they'll give you a person like, oh, their creatinine is high. They have like high calcium. They have anemia. They'll have like pain in some bone. They can have like low back pain or pain in their femur or whatever, right? Again, those people are losing all these antibodies. Those plasma cells are useless, right? That's an immunodeficiency state, recurring bacterial infections. Or if a person has nephrotic syndrome, all a person that have nephrotic syndrome keep getting all these infections. Well, they're getting it because, again, they're peeing out proteins in their urine. Again, these people can pee out antibodies. So, again, they have that risk of infections because they literally have an acquired humoral immunity problem. Or if a person has like Ménétrier's disease, right? Remember, in Ménétrier's disease, you're literally pooping out protein. If you're losing all that protein, again, you're losing either antibodies or you're losing feedstock for antibody production. Again, that's going to make you immunocompromised, right? Or if you see a person that has like an immunoglobulin deficiency, like IgA deficiency, although remember, those people tend to have like anaphylaxis, right, with blood transfusions, right? If a person has Wiskott-Aldrich syndrome, again, these are all, for the most part, humoral immunity problems. Now, the third major class, like disease pattern I want to talk about are problems of neutrophils, right? So, for example, if a person has a recurrence, I will say like probably like the big thing I want to think about with a neutrophil problem, and this is very high yield to know, and many resources don't talk about this, is again issues with catalase producing organisms, right? The thing is, catalase is an extremely important enzyme to a neutrophil. So if your neutrophils are messed up for any reason, that's going to predispose you to getting recurrent infections, classically on NBM exams, recurrent abscesses with catalase positive organisms. Usually it's going to be Staph aureus, because Staph aureus is catalase positive. But also don't forget, these people tend to get recurrent serratia infections, recurrent nocardial infections, recurrent aspergillus infections. In fact, this is one of those reasons why people that have febrile neutropenia, they tend to get like late stage aspergillus infections because their neutrophils are not working, right? So who are the classic people that tend to get neutrophil problems here? Well, again, the big one, especially in boys on exams, right? CGD, chronic granulomatous disease. Again, if you want more specifics on CGD, listen to episode 173, which is my immunodeficiency diseases podcast. That's like 150 podcasts ago, basically. Or people that have a complement protein deficiency, especially like a C3 deficiency or a C5 deficiency. Those things, again, make your neutrophils not function as well. The thing many people don't realize is that there is a very big interaction between your complement system and neutrophil function. Whenever your complement system is not working well, your neutrophils are going to have a hard time, right? So people that have issues with complement, like people that have paroxysmal nocturnal hemoglobinuria, PNH, right? Those people, right, they tend to have a lot of neutrophil problems. Again, so again, catalase positive organisms, that's the classic signature you're looking for in NBM exams. And then the fourth last pattern I'll talk about are people that have no spleen. People that have no spleen, again, the big thing you want to keep in mind are encapsulated organisms. It kind of looks the same as people that have humoral immunity problems, right? So again, strep pneumo, right? Again, that's the most common cause of infection and sepsis in these folks. Haemophilus influenza type B, like Serum meningitidis, Salmonella, right? But one thing I think I want to mention here that many people don't think about is if you have no spleen, you're going to have a hard time with like infections that affect red blood cells. Because again, remember, red blood cells are almost like disinfected or cleared by your spleen. So if you have no spleen, then infections that hide in red blood cells are going to cause you lots and lots and lots of problems, right? So for example, malaria. Malaria is really bad in people that have no spleen. Babesia microti. Remember, Babesia is carried by the Ixodes tick, right? Babesia microti can cause problems in people that have no spleen. So if they give you like, again, very bad hemolytic anemia in a person that lives in New England and is asplenic, think about Babesia potentially as the cause of that infection, right? Again, just very high yield to know these classic patterns. I'll tell you that you can almost always get about 50% of NBME questions on immunocompromised people or in your immunodeficiency disorders if you just know the classic signatures of infection. Again, I broke them up into cell-mediated immunity, humoral immunity problems, neutrophil problems. Remember, we said that neutrophil problems and complement problems, you can kind of lump them together. And then the fourth signature were people that have no spleen, right? The reason I put that fourth group of people that have no spleen is that, again, there's the classic encapsulated organisms they get infections with. But in addition to that, they also tend to get infections with red blood cell infecting organisms like Babesia microti or malaria. Very important to keep that in mind. Now, the next major topic I think I want to hit on with regards to people that are immunocompromised is just people that have febrile neutropenia. Febrile neutropenia is a pretty classic thing that is tested on NBM exams. So what is the big thing on febrile neutropenia? Basically, these people's absolute neutrophil count will be really low, right? It'll be really, really low. And really, the way you calculate a person's absolute neutrophil count is just take their white blood cell count and multiply it by the percent of neutrophils. So let's say your white blood cell count is 1,000 and your neutrophils make up 60%, then your absolute neutrophil count is going to be 60% of 1,000, which is 600. So when you see a person that has fever and a really low white blood cell count, they likely have febrile neutropenia on an NBM exam. And again, we know many of the causes of febrile neutropenia classically on NBM exams is going to be in a person that may be taking a drug that really brought down their neutrophil count. Remember these drugs that cause agranulocytosis, things like clozapine that is used to treat psychosis, things like carbamazepine that is used to treat trigeminal neuralgia, things like your antithyroid medications like PTU, methimazole. Those things can really bring down a person's neutrophil count, right? Or if a person has Felty syndrome, remember in Felty syndrome, that's the combination of rheumatoid arthritis with neutropenia, right? And splenomegaly, right? Those people, if they have that low level of neutrophils, again, that can predispose them to having febrile neutropenia, right? And also, if you think of people that are on chemotherapy, these are people, again, that can get febrile neutropenia, people that are taking radiation, right, for some kind of malignancy. Again, those people tend to have a febrile neutropenia. In fact, febrile neutropenia is the most common complication of people getting chemotherapy. Like if a person is basically being treated for cancer or for some kind of malignancy, the most common life-threatening complication is febrile neutropenia. The most common complication is very high yield, is febrile neutropenia. Now, what are some key things you want to keep in mind with febrile neutropenia? Again, I've talked about the causes. Well, some other things you can keep in mind is, if they give you a question about a person that has febrile neutropenia, and you notice that their right lower quadrant is really tender, I want you to think about necrotizing enterocolitis. People that have febrile neutropenia, they are predisposed very commonly on NBM exams to right lower quadrant necrotizing enterocolitis. That's something that sometimes is called typhlitis on NBM exams. It's basically like an inflammation of the cecum, right? But it's really, really bad, really, really life-threatening, right? Has very poor outcomes in general, right? And then another key thing I want you to keep in mind is, if you, in general, if a person is neutropenic or if a person is taking chemotherapy and you want to prevent them potentially from developing febrile neutropenia, one thing that's very helpful on NBM exams for these people is to consider giving them a G-CSF analog or a GM-CSF analog. So something like filgrastim or sagramostim, right? Many times that's really good prophylaxis against people developing febrile neutropenia in the first place. Now, if a person comes in with febrile neutropenia, what are you supposed to do for those people? The first thing you're supposed to do for those people is to get blood cultures. Blood cultures. They may give you many different kinds of cultures on your exam, because typically you're supposed to get many different kinds of cultures in these people. You're supposed to get blood cultures, you're supposed to get a lumbar puncture, get CSF cultures, you're supposed to get urine cultures. But if you have to pick one test on the NBM exam for these people, get blood cultures. Blood cultures are the things that you classically do in people that have febrile neutropenia on NBM exams. Again, this is very high yield to know for tests. And then after you get those blood cultures, what are you supposed to do treatment-wise for these people? What is like the first thing you want to do treatment-wise for these people? The high yield thing to give these people on NBM exams is an anti-pseudomonal. This is very important. Is an anti-pseudomonal antibiotic. Is an anti-pseudomonal antibiotic, right? Because many times these anti-pseudomonal antibiotics, they are very good at covering lots and lots and lots of bugs. So you want to give people things, these people things like piperacillin plus tazobactam, right? Remember, that's a combination that can treat Pseudomonas or you can give them cefepime. Cefepime is a fourth generation cephalosporin that covers Pseudomonas, or you can put them on ceftazidime. Remember, ceftazidime is a third generation cephalosporin that covers Pseudomonas. So you can put them on a carbapenem like meropenem or imipenem or doripenem. These are carbapenems. They are very good broad spectrum antibiotics. They tend to cover Pseudomonas as well, right? So that's like the first line therapy for febrile neutropenia on MBM exams. But if you notice that for some reason, you've put them on this anti-pseudomonal antibiotic, and you notice that, wow, these people don't seem to be getting better 3 days, 4 days, 5 days later, and they ask you for your next step on an MBM exam, go ahead and pick the answer that is an antifungal. Many times when you see people that have been placed on broad, so this is a construct. Again, the MBM exam is an exam of scenarios. If you notice that people that have febrile neutropenia on an MBM exam have not gotten better 3, 4, 5 days after they were started on broad spectrum antibiotic therapy, and they ask you for your next step in management, so go ahead and put these people on some kind of antifungal therapy, right? You can put them on amphotericin B if you want, or you can put them on something that covers candida, right? So like an echinocandin, right? So drugs like caspofungin or micafungin or anidolafungin, or you can put them on a drug that covers aspergillus. Many times you want to put these people on aspergillus covering medications, right? So things like voriconazole or posaconazole, right? Again, you can also use amphotericin B on MBM exams. Again, this is a very high yield construct to know for tests. And one thing I also want to say is sometimes your friends at the MBME, they give unusual presentations of neutropenia in people that are getting sulfonamide therapy. So remember, if a person is getting trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole, those things can cause bone marrow suppression. Or if a person is taking methotrexate, remember methotrexate kind of works like a sulfonamide, although it works more like in the second step in that folate synthesis pathway on dihydrofolate reductase. Or if a person is taking toxoplasmosis therapy with pyrimethamine and sulfadiazine, those people, right, very high yield to know, those people can develop febrile neutropenia. And many times the way you rescue those people's bone marrow is by giving them leucovorin. Remember, leucovorin is a folinic acid analog that can be used in these folks on MBM exams. Now, one other thing I think I want to also talk about here, since I've kind of harped on this febrile neutropenia, is let me spend some time talking about transplant patients. Again, I'm just going to try to hit on the high points that are like the most important to know for purposes of the USMLE exams, because again, these are things that people tend to confuse, and this is something that can potentially be like an extremely expansive topic that people can get wrong on exams, right? So the first thing I want you to keep in mind is that getting a transplant increases your risk of cancer, right? Because again, if you even think about it, many people have heard of the drug nivolumab. Nivolumab is an anti-cancer drug because it literally spruces up your immune system to go and kill the cancer. So the thing is, whenever you're immunocompromised, you have a high risk of malignancy. In fact, malignancies are one of the most common complications. I'm not saying the most common, but they are one of the most common complications that arises in people that are post-transplant, right? Especially like lymphomas. Like many times, people that get a transplant and they are placed on immunosuppressive therapy, I think I heard a statistic a few years ago that they have like almost like a 40-fold increased risk of lymphoma. And many times these people, especially non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and many times these people also have a high risk of like just skin cancers, especially squamous cell cancer of the skin. This is one that is particularly common in kidney transplant recipients on MBM exams. So again, it's just something you want to keep in mind, right? And then obviously, I won't be talking about this if I'm not talking about immunocompromised people, but people that are post-transplant, they tend to get lots and lots and lots of infections. They tend to get lots and lots and lots of infections. In fact, many times when people are getting transplants, before they get transplants, you want to screen them for all this bad stuff, right? What do I mean by bad stuff? You usually want to screen them for like herpes, you want to screen them for like CMV, you want to screen them for mono, you want to screen them for HIV, right? You want to screen them for Hep B, you want to screen them for Hep C, you want to screen them for syphilis, right? You want to screen them for TB. Many times, people that get transplants, they get screened pretty extensively for infectious diseases. You even screen them for other opportunistic infections like toxoplasmosis, right? There are some times before people get certain transplants, they get certain vaccines, right? They get certain vaccines. They make sure that their vaccines are up to date so that, again, they develop some kind of immunity against these infections in the first place. In fact, many times people that are getting transplants, they are placed on just prophylactic antibiotic therapy so that they don't get into trouble, right? In fact, many of these screenings for infections don't just happen right before you get the transplant. They also happen after you get the transplant. After you get the transplant, many times you're going to stay like screened for like CMV or for mono, right? Many people tend to get those screenings. So again, it's just very important to keep these things in mind for exams. And one thing I will say is, if a person gets a transplant and they're asking you, oh, which of the following interventions can be implemented to reduce the risk of opportunistic infection, I want you to think of picking an answer that says to get Bactrim, right? So that's TMPSMX. Or pick the answer that says to get Ganciclovir. It's very important to know this. The thing is, CMV and Pneumocystis jirovetsi, they love to cause infections, right? Obviously, Pneumocystis jirovetsi is going to cause a pulmonary infection. CMV usually tends to cause a GI infection, right? So if you want to prophylax against these things, you want to put people on appropriate therapy. So many times, people that get transplants for usually about like at least 3 months up to a year, they are placed on like trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole. They are placed on ganciclovir. For CMV prophylaxis, the TMPSMX obviously is going to be for, it's going to be against the Pneumocystis jirovetsi. In fact, sometimes that are getting certain transplants, especially like heart transplants, they tend to go on like toxoplasmosis prophylaxis. But again, remember, people that are getting these prophylaxis that involve sulfonamide therapy, you usually want to put those people on folinic acid at the same time so that they don't get profound bone marrow suppression. Again, you don't want these people getting profound bone marrow suppression. Again, it's very high yield to know these things. Again, some of these things may look like just weird stuff, but they are very important to know. And many times when people get infections after getting a transplant on NBM exams, is usually going to be within the first year after the transplant. Many times, to be honest with you, it's going to be within the first month after the transplant, right? So most times, if you see people get like these raging infections, it's going to be within the first month. Many times, if people make it past a year, 2 years after they've gotten a transplant, they tend to do pretty well for the most part. But usually within that first 1 year period, that's like danger zone, especially one first month. But like after that first, like the biggest danger zone is the first 4 weeks after transplant. But really, if you go beyond that 1 month, right, all these, again, CMV infections, Aspergillus infections, Pneumocystis jirovetsi, EBV, bad CMV, bad TB. And again, they usually give you hints in the question that will guide you in one direction versus the other. These are things that, again, can happen after a transplant, right? Again, very important to keep these things in mind for exams. And then another thing I want to talk about, or I guess maybe this will be the last thing I'll talk about because this podcast is kind of getting a little long, is it can give you questions on people that have like HIV, right? And their starting CD4 count is very, very low. And then you start treating them with like antiretroviral therapy, or you start treating them for some opportunistic infection. And then you notice that they have like almost like this paradoxical worsening of that infection. If you see something like that, I really want you to think about immune reconstitution syndrome. Immune reconstitution syndrome is something that they love to test on USMLE exams. So if you see a person that was immunocompromised before, and then now they're becoming immunocompetent, and then you notice that they have like a paradoxical worsening of like an opportunistic infection or something like that, or some kind of successfully treated infection, I really want you to think about immune reconstitution syndrome. So again, the thing is, that's why it's important to not just memorize associations, but understand the construct. This is the construct. previously immunocompromised, now becoming immunocompetent. Because again, the NBMEs, they know that most people have memorized the HIV association with immune reconstitution syndrome. So the thing is, you can get other kinds of people that can get immune reconstitution syndrome, right? So if, for example, a person is an organ transplant patient and they've been on immunosuppressive therapy for a long time, and then let's say for some reason you're beginning to decrease the immunosuppression, that can cause immune reconstitution syndrome because the immune system is coming back online. Or you see a woman that is postpartum. Again, remember I just explained at the beginning about how pregnancy is an immunocompromised state, and then the woman becomes postpartum and then the immune system comes back with a bang. That can cause immune reconstitution syndrome. Or a person, again, that has been on prolonged corticosteroid therapy or on prolonged TNF inhibitor therapy. Again, if those therapies are tapered or stopped, those people can get immune reconstitution syndrome on NBM exams. So again, very, very, very important to keep these things in mind for tests. Again, they can give you a person, again, that was just started on antiretroviral therapy. So typically, how do we treat immune reconstitution syndrome? For the most part, if a person has HIV and they have immune reconstitution syndrome and, you know, their symptoms are not severe, again, many times on USMLE exams, big picture is the thing that ultimately matters. If you notice that these people don't have severe symptoms, they just have like a mild fever, just mild systemic symptoms. In general, for those people, just go ahead and continue the antiretroviral therapy. It's not going to be a big problem. But if you notice that their symptoms are very severe, right? You see this person, you're like, wow, this person is like circling the drain, about to die kind of deal. You may need to go ahead and stop that antiretroviral therapy in those people, right? And many times, if you see evidence of an infection, treat that underlying infection, right? Treat that underlying infection. In some cases, if their symptoms are really severe, you can actually put these people on steroids to, again, kind of like calm down that immune system. You can put them on steroids. You can give them NSAIDs. Remember, NSAIDs, many people think of NSAIDs as just pain relievers. But NSAIDs are also anti-inflammatory medications, right? So those can help in those circumstances. And then one thing that came to mind that I want to just go ahead and share before I wrap up this podcast is, if a person is getting a transplant, you need to make sure, like before they get a transplant, on NBM exam, there are certain vaccines you're supposed to get before you get a transplant. So what are those vaccines? You want to think of the DTaP vaccine. The DTaP vaccine should be given to everybody before they get a transplant, right? The pneumococcal vaccine, you should get it before you get a transplant. The influenza vaccine, you should get it before you get a transplant. And then vaccination against Hep A and Hep B, you should get it before a transplant. Again, this is very, 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 important to know for exams, right? So the way I remember this is, I remember this as your A, your B, your D, right? And then intellectual property, IP. That's the way I remember that. So your A is Hep A, you get the Hep A vaccine. Your B is Hep B, you get the Hep B vaccine. Your D is the DTaP vaccine. And then IP in intellectual property, the I is the influenza vaccine, and then the P is the pneumococcal vaccine. In general, before you get a transplant, you need to get these prophylactic vaccines so that you don't get in trouble with a transplant. So thank you for listening to this podcast. As I do at the end of every podcast, I again offer review courses for the USMLE exams, especially Step 2 CK, Step 3. I offer an NBME test taking strategies course, and I have my videos on my YouTube channel. It's called the Divine Intervention USMLE Podcasts and Videos. So if you sign up for that, that's where you see all my videos, all my shelf review videos and stuff. But if you want the slides that go along with these videos, then go to the website, divineinterventionpodcasts.com, under the specific episodes. And then I also have these podcasts on Apple Podcasts, on Google Podcasts, and on Spotify. So if you want the most recent 150 podcasts, go to those podcast apps and just subscribe to the podcast and you'll get them. The thing is, you may wonder, okay, Divine, how about the podcasts that are older than the most recent 150? Well, those older podcasts, they're on the website, divineinterventionpodcast.com. I have just really... it's either I'm pretty sure it's a WordPress rule, but I'm not able to put more than the most recent 150 podcasts on any of these podcast apps. So if you want everything from episode 1 all the way to episode 323, which is this episode, go ahead and go to the website and you'll see those podcasts. You can listen to them from the website. You can literally download them from the website. And again, if you subscribe to my website, Divine Intervention Podcasts with an S at the end, .com, then you'll usually get an email notification whenever I make a new podcast. So thank you for listening to this podcast. Again, the quick life lesson I want to share, which is something I kind of shared already in the life lessons podcast that I made on my Divine Intervention Life Lessons podcast. Again, remember, if you go to divineinterventionlifelessons.com, you'll see those. But the quick thing I want to just say is, make sure whenever you're doing something in life, make sure you're doing it with the right motivation, right? Ask yourself, where is my motivation coming from? This is particularly important in many of us that are in medicine, right? Because the thing is, if you have the right motivation, then you'll be able to stand the test of time when adversity comes. Because the thing is, whether you like it or not, you will face adversity. If you make any kind of decent commitment in life, adversity will come, right? So make sure you have the right kind of motivation. Because again, if you have the wrong motivation behind things, when adversity comes, you will completely fall away. But if you have the right kind of motivation, when adversity comes, you'll be able to stand the test of time. So don't draw your motivation from human beings. Don't draw your motivation from the congratulations of men. Because again, just as quickly as men can congratulate you and give you all this praise, it is the same men that can crucify you and assassinate your character. So draw your purpose from things that are not ephemeral. Draw your motivation from things that are permanent. Draw your motivation from God, from your calling, from your purpose. Like, ask yourself, what am I doing on this earth? Let that be the thing that is driving what you're doing. Because if the thing driving your what you're doing is, oh, I want to be praised by men. I want to be rewarded by men. I want people to like my posts on Facebook. Or I want people to say good things about me. If that's where your motivation is from, I have bad news for you. You are liable to get completely just sidelined by adversity. Right? Because adversity will come in different ways. Adversity can come just straight up adversity. It can come from intense opposition, right? The thing is, whenever something good is being done, whenever a commitment has been made, opposition will come, right? But again, the thing that will keep you going through that opposition, will keep you going through that problem, is if you have the right motivation, right? So again, one example I like giving is, again, you see people, they're like, oh, I want to get a 270 on step one, on step two, CK, or step three, so that I can show off, I can put it on Facebook, I can put it in my CV, I can brandish it before program directors and stuff. Don't get me wrong. Is there anything wrong with that? Maybe not, although I have my own thoughts on that, but I'm not going to bring that here. Those are my private personal thoughts. But the thing is, after, let's say they study really hard, that strong score comes, right? And then people celebrate them and give them that wonderful pat on the back. After all those things are gone, then what next? You see those people, sometimes they almost slide into depression. You see, because have you ever wondered, there are some people that are really successful, but then they are really depressed. Again, there are many things that cause depression. This is just one cause, right? But again, some people have these unmet or unfulfilled expectations, right? So again, those should not be your motivations for studying hard to do well on USMLE exams. Your motivation should be that, oh, I'm learning this material so that I can help people. I'm learning this material so that I can turn people's lives around. I'm learning this material so that I can do right by my patients. I'm learning this material so that when a patient presents, I will understand exactly why they're presenting and I'll be able to do the very best for them. If you have the right motivation, then it doesn't matter what happens. An attending pisses you off, or a resident yells at you, or someone says the wrong things about you, right? At the end of the day, you know why you're going into medicine. You have those motivations. You know why you're studying, right? So when you're studying, like, it motivates you, right? Because when you have the right kind of motivation, then it's almost like you're standing on a sure foundation. You're standing on the right footing. So it's very, very important. It's very, very important. It's very, very important. Have the right motivation, right? Have the right motivation. Don't draw your motivation from people. Don't draw your happiness from the good things that people say about you. Because again, just as quickly as people can see good things about you, the same people can see bad things about you, right? Bipolarity is not just a psychiatric disorder. It's just something that we find in mankind, right? People today, they can be praising you, and then tomorrow they can be tearing you down, right? So it's just very, very important, have the right kind of motivation. If you're doing something, ask yourself, what is the purpose behind this thing? What is my calling behind this thing, right? Like, for example, these podcasts, I love making these podcasts because I want people to learn. I want people to understand. I want people to do well on exams. I want people to use this information to succeed. That is my motivation, right? That is my motivation. So the thing is, if you have that kind of motivation, because for me, I know that teaching for me is not just something I do or something that I'm good at. Thankfully, I'm really good at teaching, right? But teaching for me is a calling. Like, I feel like that's one of the primary reasons why I'm on this earth. I'm not on this earth because, oh, I'm just here to pass the time, hit a certain age, go to some place. No. That is not why I'm on this earth. That is literally not why I'm on this earth. And I will challenge you, people that are listening to this podcast, ask yourself, why am I here? Everyone on this earth has a purpose on this earth. You have a calling on this earth. You have certain people's lives you're supposed to touch on this earth, right? Ask yourself, what is that motivation? The thing is, you begin to live a full life when you know what your motivations are and when you have those right motivations. So again, I'll strongly encourage you, have that motivation. Don't let your motivation be how many likes you get on Facebook or how many positive comments you get on Twitter or whatever, or the praises of men. No, I'm telling you, just as quickly as men can praise you, men can also quickly destroy you, right? And even there's a part of the Bible that talks about how you see some people, they pray in the streets and stuff so that men can congratulate them, so men can see how pious they are and how, oh wow, they're so in touch, you know, they are prayer warriors and stuff. No, right? The Bible says that your heavenly Father that sees what you do in secret will reward you openly. The thing is, if you have the right motivation and you are doing the right thing, even if you may face some temporary adversity, in the long run, you will succeed. In the long run, you'll be rewarded. In the long run, you'll prosper, right? Again, the thing is, you cannot tell the results of a game by looking at the scores at halftime. I mean, for those of you that watch the NBA, I'm sure you've watched games where it was like, wow, 70 to 46, right? You're like, oh, gee, man, this team is completely gone. But then you notice that by the end of the game, wow, the people, you see these people, they just mount this great mighty comeback, right? And then they win, right? So again, you should never judge anything until the very end. It's the very end that determines who is the winner, who is the true winner, and who is the true loser, right? So again, have the right motivations. So thank you for listening to this podcast. I hope you're blessed by it. I'll see you next time. God bless you. Thank you.